Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Why is it important to study and understand the Jewish question? The Jews are presently the most powerful and wealthiest ethnic group on this planet. And it is their power structure which is pushing to terminate the existence of our race through replacement migration. It is they who are the true power behind the Muslim and the other brown invasions across the borders of America and in Europe and wherever white people live. It is they who demonize any who oppose the invasion by calling them racist, trying to get them shunned, isolated, and unemployable. It is they who created an inverted morality, which teaches our children and our brothers and sisters that they are evil if they want our race to continue to exist. It is they who own and control the mass media, which are spreading the false narrative about Charlottesville, that white racists killed Heather Heyer, and using the emotions they generate with their lies to deplatform and economically destroy and deny the rights of the writers, publishers, and activists who are trying to expose their crimes. The National Alliance, the sponsor of this radio program, has lost its credit card processor and its online store software provider, making it temporarily impossible to sell books and CDs or take donations online in just the last week alone. So the Jewish power structures, lies, and hate have very real consequences. You can never solve a problem that you don't understand. So it is imperative to understand why the Jews have chosen to do this. There is no man more qualified to explain this to us than the late Revelo Oliver, one of the greatest writers and scholars of the 20th century. This week we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on the subject under the title The Jewish Plague, Part 2. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. If we are to be rational, the racial solidarity of the Jews forces on us a most humiliating confession of our own inferiority. Our impassioned anti-Semites depict the Jews as not only vulgar and barbarous, that is, with manners that we so consider, but also as treacherous and greedy. But as a matter of fact, we cannot identify with confidence a single Jew who betrayed his race for profit or any other consideration. While we know that most Aryans will cheerfully betray their race for a few $100, say $500 to allow for high ideals, or even for a pat on the head and a prospect of future profit. The number of Aryans who have even recognized the common interest of their race, although they know it to be a small and hated minority among the prolific and invidious races who form the bulk of this planet's population, is extremely small. One exception to the rule was Commander Josiah Tatnall of the U.S. Navy, who in 1859 led the American squadron in China to the assistance of the British gunboats that were trying to force a passage of the Chinese forts at the mouth of the Pei-ho. Quoting the once proverbial expression, quote, "Blood is thicker than water," close quote. It is significant that, if I have been correctly informed, his statue in the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis has been removed, since he was so wicked as to think that Aryans are fit to live. Americans, it seems, have been so well trained by the Jews that they now accept a status as tax-paying animals that exist so that all the vermin of the world can eat and excrete on them. It is noteworthy that during the war in Vietnam, when packs of febrile and neurotic young Americans, incited and led, of course, by Jewish agitators, formed mobs to scream protests, they howled about the suffering of the sweet Mongoloid Vietnamese, but never mentioned the young Americans who had been sent into that racial cesspool to be killed or infected with Oriental diseases for the purpose of further advertising the degradation and impotence of their nation and of providing a pretext for sucking more blood from the imbecile taxpayers. The death of American soldiers was not even considered by the screeching agitators, evidently on the assumption that that was what Americans were for. And, as a matter of fact, an American lieutenant, a commissioned officer in the Army, was later convicted and imprisoned because he had killed some Vietnamese instead of letting himself be killed by them, as an Aryan should. And when it was thought that the United States had been sufficiently disgraced and made contemptible in the eyes of all its enemies, a peace was arranged by one of the Jewish masters. The stupid American taxpayers were further afflicted with reparations to compensate their enemies, and several hundred young American soldiers, prisoners of the enemy, were gladly abandoned to be kept in cages or tortured to death, as might most please their captors. They were just Aryan curs, after all, and therefore obviously expendable. To such self-imposed debasement our race has come, and it is not perhaps remarkable that Aryans employed by the Jews in the press and television gladly cooperate in the offensive against their own nation and race in return for the salary paid them and the approval of their masters. In sharp and terrible contrast to our race's suicidal mania, the Jews could legitimately boast that no Jew has ever knowingly betrayed his race. It is true that they do not avail themselves of that proof of superiority, but instead wail about betrayals. But that so corresponds to the standard and inveterate Jewish technique of making themselves seem persecuted that one is inclined to question every instance of supposed betrayal that they adduce. One hears most often Jewish execration of Pfefferkorn, the Jew who, having had himself sprinkled with the Christian's magic water, became a Dominican and disclosed to the Goyim some of the contents of the Babylonian Talmud. No one can now ascertain what was in Pfefferkorn's mind, but if we view him historically, it is obvious that he, knowingly or unwittingly, played a very important and possibly crucial role in inciting the great religious schism in Europe in the early 16th century, and thus performed a great service for his compatriots, inciting the Goyim to butcher one another for centuries and to devastate their own countries, to the great profit as well as the spiritual satisfaction of the Jews then residing in Europe. The Jews speak bitterly of Henry Klein, a Jewish attorney who, during the premature Jewish terror in the United States in 1944, did not betray his American clients, as a good Jewish lawyer should, but defended them before the Jewish federal judge who had been appointed by our great war criminal to destroy them and thus terrorize all American curs who dared not to lick the boots of their masters. The Jews so persecuted Klein that he denounced the Zionists, for example, in his booklet, Zionism Rules the World, which he had printed at his own expense in 1955, before he was hounded to suicide. But note well, he denounced the Zionists, not his own race. And it is only reasonable to believe that he, however mistakenly, believed that he was protecting his compatriots in the United States, not harming them. It must be remembered that even in 1944, the Americans were not so prostrate and cowed as they now are. In 1939 to 1940, for example, it was possible for an American, Paul Beschers, who had enjoyed a brief season of political prominence a few years before, to assure his Jewish friends, quote, "If you drive us into a war against Germany, it will not be long before Americans are shooting Jews on Michigan Avenue in Chicago without a hunting license." Close quote. Some Jews were, he says, impressed by that prediction in 1940, and quite a few well-informed Americans, including officers in the Armed Services Intelligence Corps, during the war of 1941 to 1945, expected very drastic reprisals against the Jews after that war. It is against such a background that Klein's supposed betrayal of his race must be understood. The majority of Jews hate Benjamin Friedman, who quoted a few well-known passages in the Talmud and other Jewish writings that the lowly Goyim should not be permitted to see, in his books Facts Are Facts and The Hidden Tyranny. Friedman, unlike the many Jews who had themselves sprinkled with holy water and worked themselves up to positions of power in the various Christian churches during the Middle Ages and in the time of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, incurred the venomous hatred of many Jews. When I met him many years ago, he told me, I assume truthfully, that when he and his wife were in an elevator of the very expensive apartment building in New York City in which he then lived, and the very rich Jews who lived in the same building entered the same elevator, they would spit all over his and his wife's clothing to show their disapproval by a typical Jewish gesture. Friedman, however, did not intend to betray his race. On the contrary, he was convinced, it seems mistakenly, that he was racially a real Jew, whereas most Jews were Turco-Mongolians who had disguised themselves as Jews and cunningly come to dominate the Jewish race, which he certainly did not intend to depreciate, much less betray. On the contrary, he imagined that he was at great self-sacrifice, protecting his own people from the reprisals that might someday fall upon them. The clearest example of the betrayal of Jews by a Jew would be the famous Protocols of the Elders of Zion, if, as is maintained in some accounts of their publication, that document was sold by a Jew to the Russian intelligence services for a fee. The Jews, however, vociferously claim that the protocols are a forgery. This allegation was long accepted on the grounds that it was extremely unlikely that Jews would rashly put in writing so candid a statement of their purposes. And it was generally believed that the document was forged by a white man who had a phenomenal knowledge of the Jews and an astounding ability to predict what they would do in subsequent decades. Recent exhibitions of Jewish arrogance and contempt for the Aryan mentality suggest, however, a reconsideration of the problem. It may be doubted whether any man of our race could have so perfectly anticipated and described in the last years of the 19th century the policies that the Jews put into effect in the 20th, down to the present time. But however that may be, we cannot regard the protocols as proof that a Jew betrayed his own race. Jews often denounce as a traitor Benjamin Disraeli, who in his Coningsby, 1844, and many speeches and books, down to his Endymion, 1880, candidly told the British that the only real issue was that of race, and further told them that all the governments of Europe were really controlled by Jews, who operated behind the scenes and dictated the policies of the ostensible rulers, whether monarchs or elected officials. Some of our people, including the late Douglas Reed in his posthumous Controversy of Zion, think that Disraeli was trying to warn the British about the power and purposes of Zionists. I do not profess to know what was in Disraeli's mind. I would not presume to guess that even if he had been a member of our race, instead of belonging to a race whose mentality is so different from our own that we can only make conjectures about its processes. But I observe that he could have issued the supposed warnings with the assurance that the Anglo-Saxons were too stupid to understand them, and that his pronouncements on that subject, like his unconventional behavior and garish clothing, served so to advertise him that he attained political power in Britain, became the first admittedly alien prime minister of the British Empire, and the first undisguised Jew to enter the House of Lords as the Earl of Beaconsfield. In 1858, Lord Harrington, commenting on the international race's parasitic plundering of all nations through international finance, control of the press, and revolutionary agitation, pointed out that Jews acquire citizenship in a nation only to sabotage it. He was supported by Lord Galloway, who remarked that if a Jewish subversion of Great Britain were not checked, the time might come when a corrupt prime minister could be bribed to have a title of British nobility conferred on one of the aliens. 10 years later, Disraeli became the prime minister of the British Empire. And in 1876, he became the Earl of Beaconsfield, while Jews throughout the world snickered at another proof that Goyim never learn. How great was the corrosion of English character in those years may be estimated from a single datum. One of the foremost British novelists, Louise Ramey, or Ouida, in her Strathmore, 1865, casually mentioned in a descriptive passage, quote, "The vampires of Israel, who like their forefather and first usurer, Jacob, know well how to deal with the famished, and sell us our mess of pottage at no smaller price than our birthright." Close quote. No one was perturbed by her passing reference to what everyone knew. But less than a century later, such a reference by a novelist would have been suicidal audacity. Her publishers would have been at once driven into bankruptcy. Her book, however praiseworthy for its literary qualities, would not have been mentioned by any reviewer. She would have been defamed in all the newspapers as a Nazi. And all well-trained English nitwits would have shrunk in loathing from the contamination of her presence. The Anglo-Saxons not only cower before the Jewish terror, but pride themselves on their servitude. It is not a mere coincidence that Strathmore was published 3 years before a Jew became the Queen's Prime Minister, thus climaxing a prolonged and patient subversion of the upper classes by usury, bribes, and the technique of marrying Jewesses with large dowries to the sons of avaricious noblemen or members of the landed gentry. The Jews complain bitterly of certain members of their tribe who published in the United States in the 1930s indiscreetly candid comments on the innate differences between Jews and our race. The worst offender was probably Samuel Roth, who, having been repeatedly swindled by Jews and told that he must suffer in silence for the sake of racial solidarity, published his Jews Must Live in 1934, writing in, quote, an agony of spirit, close quote, to describe conduct and habits that were, in any case, apparent to any careful observer, of what another Jew boastfully called the nation within the United States. I do not question Roth's sincerity, but did his comment on, quote, the hideous swamp the Jews have made of Western civilization, close quote, impair the power of the ubiquitous tribe from which he defected? The answer is obvious. 2 years before Roth wrote, the German people, on whom the Jews had fed for centuries before Disraeli specifically noted that whatever the stupid Germans might imagine, their nation was really governed by Jewish financiers. Those German people made a courageous effort to acquire control of their own country and become an independent nation. The result? We all know. The Jews, through their control of the press and of numerous hirelings, of whom Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt are merely the most loathsome specimens, stampeded great hordes of crazed Aryans from Britain, France, and the United States into Germany to commit outrages that forever forfeited their claim to be civilized men, thus giving to the world an unforgettable lesson of what happens to Aryan dogs who dare to disobey their divinely appointed masters. Does anyone wonder that the Jews feel a sovereign contempt for cattle that are so easily herded? And can a rational observer fail to ask whether that contempt is not amply justified? You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 2, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, yours truly, Kevin Alfred Strom. Next time, Dr. Oliver will explore the subject of why, after World War II, the Jewish attitude toward whites profoundly changed. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, just visit us at nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist scholar, and teacher, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, next week on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. The National Alliance is working to educate white men and women around the world as to the nature of the reality we must face, and organizing our people to ensure our survival and advancement. To help us, send donations to National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. For free flyers to spread the truth in your community, visit natall.com/flyers. That's natall.com/flyers. Once again, our postal address is Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you of the words of Richard Berkeley Cotton. Freedom is not free. Free men are not equal, and equal men are not free.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil.